Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. Whether you're on the road or cozying up to a nice fire, or maybe even taking a walk with your streaming device, you are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, 95.9 FM, and streaming at kgvm.org. This is Desert Oracle Radio, and I'm your host, Roxana. In the second half of the show today, you'll hear part one of my interview with author Joan Ruth Bird. But first, let's open the show with a kind of audio road trip produced by Ken Lane. I wonder if anyone has ever created such a road map for our area. Well, it sounds like a fun project. Let me know if you do it. From November 30th, 2018, here is Highways and Aliens.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and the November issue of Nevada Public Radio's Desert Companion has a map written by your late night announcer. So if you're passing through Las Vegas, the Las Vegas suburbs, Clark County, the general area, hopefully you picked up a copy of this issue. It's got a nice illustrated map to accompany the text, but half the descriptions did not make the issue due to space considerations. Space on the printed page. So I figured I'd tell you about these places tonight. And if you want to see the map, you can go to our website, desertoracle.com, and I've got it linked there. This drive makes for a nice 2 or 3 or 5 day road trip around the Mojave, as long as nothing terrible happens to you along the way. And it's going to start on the eastern edge of Death Valley National Park, a little hole in the ground that goes straight to hell itself, maybe. And if you are making a desert road trip, always plan accordingly. Let somebody know where you're going if you have anyone who cares. And if you don't have anyone who cares, let them know over at the National Park Visitor Center. Bring plenty of water. Bring plenty of beer. You never know what the beer situation is going to be. Bring some shoes. You don't want to go staggering around in the desert in a pair of flip-flops or high heels or whatever. Bring some hiking boots or tennis shoes or galoshes. Doesn't really matter. Be prepared. Give a hoot. Stop one on our desert tour is Devil's Hole on the aptly named Devil's Hole Road in Nye County, Nevada. This National Park Service protected opening to an ancient limestone aquifer with 92 degree Fahrenheit water is home to the endangered Devil's Hole pupfish and has been fenced in like a prison yard since two young divers vanished below in 1965. Goldstone Deep Space Communications Complex at 93 Goldstone Road, Fort Irwin, California. one of three deep space network antenna sites in remote spots around the world. Goldstone's giant antennas south of Death Valley National Park allow communication with NASA's far-flung satellites, space probes, and robot rovers. It is closed to the public. Next, we have Barker Ranch. Goler Wash Road, also in Death Valley National Park, following the Tate LaBianca murders in Los Angeles. Charles Manson and his family hid at this remote Panamint Mountains ranch until their arrest for suspicion of car theft and vandalism in Death Valley. Only some burnt-out remains and foundations remain to amuse the morbid visitor. And back on the Nevada side, we have Ash Meadows Sky Ranch. On East Nye County Road, number 266, Amargosa Valley, Nevada, long abandoned but once the fanciest brothel in Nevada, complete with an airstrip, a restaurant, a swimming pool. It was here at the bar where Edward Abbey wrote Desert Solitaire on breaks from his school bus driver job in Death Valley. Hemingway Park. No, not Hemingway. It's Hemingway. Nobody knows why. Boulder City, Nevada. You want to arrive before sunrise. Sit quietly at the picnic tables and you will likely see more desert bighorn sheep coming down to eat the park's green grass than you would in years of wilderness hiking. Don't tell anybody. And then to the Art Bell home and radio station, 9041 Desert Lane in Pahrump. The legendary late night radio host died in 2018, but you can drive by his Kingdom of Nye compound with its radio towers lining Thorn Road. And please just drive by and enjoy the view, as this is a private residence and Art is no longer there anyway. Goldwell Open Air Museum, 1 Golden Street, Rhyolite, Nevada. Home to Albert Sukowski's ghostly sculpture, The Last Supper, and also home to a 25-foot-tall naked Lego lady, this 8-acre outdoor museum is the center of the intriguing ghost town of Rhyolite. Don't miss the Bottle House. Onward to Little Alien, 9631 Old Mill Road, Rachel, Nevada. Converted to an alien-themed bar and diner in 1991 to serve UFO tourists here to see the weird lights over Area 51. This friendly stop on the extraterrestrial highway has appeared in the X-Files. Desert National Wildlife Refuge, headquarters at 16001 Corn Creek Road in Las Vegas. A half dozen mountain ranges, piney campsites, and abundant desert wildlife can be found in this 1.6 million acre national treasure just north of Las Vegas. And the Trump administration is trying to steal most of it to expand the bombing range next door. Enjoy it while you can. And after that kind of adventure, you're going to need a beverage. So head over to the Pioneer Saloon, 310 Nevada 161 in Good Springs, Nevada. This legendary watering hole north of Gene was built in 1913. And it was here that Clark Gable waited out the search on a nearby mountaintop, where his wife Carol Lombard was among the 22 killed in the January 1942 crash of TWA Flight 3. Next, we have the Singing Dunes of Kelso, Kelso Dunes Trail, in the middle of Mojave National Preserve, which you can access from Baker, California. Here you will find 45 square miles of shifting sand dunes. The eerie chorus of goblin voices you hear while walking the crest of a dune is created by sand shifting under your weight. Or maybe there are really goblins, I don't know. Zizek's Road Desert Studies Center, Zizek's, California, off the I-15, Doc Curtis Springer, an old-time radio evangelist and miracle cure huckster, had Los Angeles winos build his health resort here on the old Mojave Road at Soda Springs. But he was evicted by the Bureau of Land Management in 1974 because he had no right to build there. Rocket Site Road, Air Force Propulsion Lab, Boron, California. Just southwest of Boron is a harsh desert mountain lined with the hulks of old and new rocket engines. Lumen Ridge, the rocket test site run by NASA and Edwards AFB. Don't get caught up there. Now, if you watched the third season of Twin Peaks, you might enjoy seeing Agent Cooper and Diane's Desert Motel. It's at 13250 Pear Blossom Highway in Pear Blossom, California. After performing some sort of electrical voodoo ritual at a utility tower-lined section of nearby Mount Emma Road, the characters stop for a last weird night at the spooky Pear Blossom Motel, which is a real motel. Stay there if you dare. Goff's Schoolhouse, 37198 Landfair Road in Goff's, California. This 1914 mission-style schoolhouse served a scattered and... Yeah, we're out of time for the map. We're out of time for the map, and now we're going to talk to our friend Jeremy Corbell, and we're going to talk to him about his new movie about Bob Lazar. Bob Lazar, the Area 51 guy. The guy who said he worked on flying saucers. Welcome to the program, Jeremy.
So this story starts in Las Vegas, actually in the desert north of Las Vegas, in 1989. A man named Bob Lazar came forward on the news with reporter George Knapp and said that he was part of a program, a government program, to attempt and reverse engineer, back engineer, alien spacecraft, an alien propulsion system, a gravity wave amplification system, a non-reactionary system, a field propulsion system. We're talking about hardware, alien hardware, extraterrestrial hardware from another world. And he claimed he was part of that program, a military program to make these devices using earthly materials. And he said it was a fool's errand. There was absolutely no way to do it. And recently he said that he thinks these were recovered through an archaeological dig of some sort, as if they are ancient in some way. So that's Bob Lazar. That's why you know about Area 51. That's why you've heard that term. It's because of Bob Lazar, and it's because of George Knapp in 1989, and they have put forward this story that forever changed popular culture from X-Files and the craft running on something called Element 115. They got that from Bob Lazar, from Independence Day. And the craft, that's the Bob Lazar character when they go and look at the alien spacecraft. It has permeated all culture, the Bob Lazar story. And so that is what this story is about. However, he's like a mix between Elvis and Sasquatch. He is ungettable. He has barely talked over 30 years because George Knapp's the only one that could pull a few minutes out of him. He is a reluctant UFO messiah. He does not do interviews, barely, except for with George throughout the years. And he definitely doesn't make you know, the circuit tours on UFO panels. He runs a scientific business out of Michigan, and he is almost disinterested. He is disinterested in the popular UFO culture. However, with my charming personality, I was able to convince him to allow me to make a movie about his life and bring people up to date. So that is why I'm excited, Ken.
Now, Bob Lazar was no shrinking violet. He had a deal with New Line Cinema to make a movie in the early 90s. He had branded merchandise with the tester models and all of that. So are you saying that recently he became more private? Because he was all over the place, and I'm sure, I mean, what is the story? Let me ask you this. What happened to his New Line film deal?
Yeah, okay, so let's kind of get to the crux of this. You know, Bob has never pursued capitalizing off of his UFO story. Everybody around him and their mothers have tried to almost merchandise Bob Lazar himself. He has stayed true to the story. Yes, it is fact that at one point New Line Cinema was going to do a major motion picture, but Bob is so strict with telling the story as it happened. He probably only agreed to that because he was told that it was going to come out just like the story happened. He wanted people to know the story. The moment they started fictionalizing anything, they put in too much stuff to distract from the actual story. He is interested in the science and the technology. So the one restriction he put on me is I could not fabricate anything to sensationalize it. And look, that was easy to do because the story is sensational in and of itself. But it is true, no filmmaker, no film company have ever been able to break through that sound barrier and make a movie on Bob Lazar. And after 30 years, I'm proud to say I did it.
And this is your third documentary in a row about American alien and UFO mythology.
That's right. Patient 17 was first, then it was Hunt for the Skinwalker. And this will be the third one I always wanted to make, called Bob Lazar, Area 51, and Flying Saucers. For 30 years, Bob Lazar has almost allowed people to twist and distort his story because he didn't correct them. And his critics have been holding the mic for 30 years. And it's time to take the mic back. It's time to write the story, and it's time to correct the inaccuracies. If you want to dismiss a message, you simply need to dehumanize the messenger. And this is precisely what is done by intelligence agencies, what is done by governments. This tactic has been used against Bob Lazar for the last 30 years. And this is one of the things that is so tragic about the story. And that's one of the things we're trying to remedy with this movie, because dehumanizing the messenger is an attempt to take away the power of the story. If you give Bob Lazar the benefit of the doubt, you have to consider the implications. He might speak softly and he might speak gently, but what he's saying has atomic energy. The concept, not only that we are not alone in the universe, but that we have been and are being visited by an intelligent, highly technologically advanced culture of beings. We do live in a different world now. We live in a world where since December of 2017, it was admitted by the United States military that they have an ongoing program and interest in the UFO topic and chasing these AAVs, anomalous aerial vehicles, these UFOs, these craft that way outpace anything that we have and humans have ever been able to make, with propulsion systems that appear completely different than a reactionary propulsion system. We now live in a world where we know this is true, which sheds a completely different light on the story of Bob Lazar and back engineering an alien propulsion system for the United States military. We can no longer dismiss his story because it's uncomfortable. We now have to look at it from a factual standpoint and try to determine for ourselves reality.
Now, Bob Lazar has always been a very polarizing figure among people who already believe in UFOs.
You need to be skeptical. If you're not skeptical, then you're never going to land anywhere where you have an opinion that is based upon a foundation where you can utilize it for any type of action. So you need to be skeptical. What you're talking about are two things. One is the concept of belief, and I want to hit upon that. But you're also specifically asking about the education of Bob Lazar. This is the one thing that the detractors go to and try to pick apart, that he lied about his education, that he didn't go to MIT or Caltech, and that debases his entire story. So let's get to the core of this. When people do that, these people, they simply want to be able to determine. It's not about the schooling. They want to determine, is Bob Lazar a liar or is he not? Yeah, they want to know if he should be trusted because of what he's saying about UFOs. So they're picking on this education thing, which he's never been able to prove. I've never been able to prove. George Knapp has never been able to prove. So we need to come to the determination. If we can't prove it, then what's the worst case scenario? Let's accept that. Okay, worst case scenario would be that he lied about it to get a job at Los Alamos. Because guess what? We know for a fact he was a working physicist at the Maison Particle Accelerator at Los Alamos, just like he said. And in my film, I prove it again. It was proved in 1989, it's proven again. So I don't care if he was homeschooled. I care if he worked on flying saucers. And the fact that we can prove that he worked as a physicist at Los Alamos with a Q clearance, it is then plausible. And his story actually completely adds up about meeting Ed Teller, the, you know, godfather of the atomic bomb, and Ed Teller bringing him into this secret cabal program of 22 people to back engineer alien spacecraft. So even if we accept the worst case scenario, we can't prove it or it's not true. Either one is fine with me. What I do know is that there is an S-4 south of Area 51 that is confirmed in 1989 by George Knapp. Nobody knew that before Bob Lazar said it. Nowhere. It was not printed anywhere. It was not publicized. How did he know? How did he know that there would be test flights of something that looked identical to a flying saucer on Wednesday nights in the middle of the desert south of Area 51? Not even at Area 51. How did he know? He showed that on three different occasions, three different weekends, to groups of people, groups of friends, and I've talked to them all. Not all of them. Talked to most of them. But they all confirmed that story.
Right. So let's go to the story a little bit, because it is a very interesting part of the pre-media Bob Lazar story. This is just Lazar and his friends and his wife. They're driving out to the south end of the Groom Lake test area on certain nights.
Yeah, they were caught on the third trip. So here's the short of it. Bob Lazar couldn't tell his wife, like any employee, even just working at Area 51, can't tell their families or wives or partners that they are working out on special projects, other than saying, I go out there. They could say that. So he had to go to work at very strange times. Now, he allowed his phone to be tapped. So at the time, his wife thought he was cheating on her. She started cheating on him, and they were tapping his lines as he allowed them to do that, to monitor his calls, and they found out his wife was cheating on him. So if you're working on highly sensitive government projects, that is considered a instability, and you need to have stability. So they stopped calling him to work. He got scared because of all the stuff he knew. He also wanted to show his friends that he wasn't lying. So on three different occasions, he took out close friends of his and his wife at the time to witness or view these test flights of a flying saucer over Papoose Lake. And they did so at a distance, and on one occasion, they filmed it. On their third trip out, they got busted. They got busted by security and by local deputies, and they were held and detained shortly, you know, for a short amount of time. The next day, his boss, Dennis Mariani, picks him up, and they take him to a base, and at gunpoint, they threaten his life and his wife's life. That was real. That happened. So in many ways, the Bob Lazar story, there are elements that can be verified. You need to take in everything. Bob Lazar is not prone to fantasy. He does not fictionalize. Everybody says, you know, tries to make it seem like because Bob Lazar has gone bankrupt, or because Bob Lazar installed security cameras at a brothel, or they can't prove his education. Everybody tries to pin on Bob something on his character, which is simply not true. And that is, they try to make him seem unstable. They try to make him seem untrustworthy. And I have found exactly the opposite. As Mickey Rourke says in my film, beliefs are mercurial things. They shape us. And we need to be careful what we believe. If you give Bob a chance to tell you his story, not twisted, not diluted, not distorted versions, but from the man himself. You won't have the luxury of disbelief if you hear all the facts. Is it possible that Balthazar was fooled or he was tricked by an intelligence agency to permeate this UFO lore across the globe? And let me tell you, Bob has even thought about that. But we have a problem with that theory. Bob has always differentiated between the things that he physically saw and touched and knows and the things he was shown and told and read while being briefed for this project of reverse engineering alien spacecraft. So on one level, he'll say, I don't know if the things I read in the briefings are true. They were black and white. They were words on paper. I can't tell you that was true. However, he says, I did see images of autopsies of alien beings. Those were photographs. But what he knows for sure is what he had his physical hands on. And you cannot fake this. This is where he gets firm with it. You cannot fake what he was shown. You cannot fake gravity distortion.
Unlike your previous two documentaries, you have brought in some outside firepower for this one. Won't you tell me about the narrator?
That's right. Oscar-nominated actor Mickey Rourke is doing the narration for the film Balthazar, Area 51, and Flying Saucers. It launches officially December 4th. It unlocks, but you can pre-order it now. The world premiere, the live world premiere on December 3rd. That's going to be at the theater at the Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. I would get them online in advance because we're thinking it's going to sell out. ExtraordinaryBeliefs.com.
Being an ancient alien myself, I remember when the Lazar story started showing up on the Area 51 news groups back in 1989. And whatever you think of Lazar's story, there's no denying that this tale of reverse-engineered flying saucers was just what America wanted at the dawn of our most paranoid era. The paranoid era we are still in. It's history, it's internet culture, it's American folklore, and for those reasons, if you're in Los Angeles on Monday night, December 3rd, head over to the theater at the Ace Hotel in downtown LA and see the premiere. Bob Lazar will be there to take your questions and abuse. What a strange chapter in American history. Not as strange as the current one. Although they are all connected by paranoia and old-fashioned scams and a lot of lonely people looking up at the skies and wondering and hoping. Wondering and hoping that maybe there's something else, maybe something better. I do it myself. Look up at the sky anyway. Thanks to everybody who turned up at the Campfire Circle at the Palm Springs Ace Hotel for our Desert Oracle Campfire Stories last Wednesday night. We've got one more night scheduled down there in the low desert for this blessed, cursed year of 2018. Thursday, December 27, that's two nights after Christmas, I'll be there at the Fire Ring from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. telling tales of the desert of monstrosities, both human and supernatural. You've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from Joshua Tree, California, Fridays at 10 p.m. across the Mojave on KCDZ 107.7 FM from Amboy to Zizix. Thanks, as always, to Red, Blue, Black, Silver for the musical soundscapes he composes here in the high desert, especially for this program. We are distributed everywhere on the internet and by Public Radio Exchange, PRX. I'm your host, Ken Lane. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, transmitting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. My guest today is author, researcher, and zoologist Joan Ruth Bird. I got to hear her speak this summer and am blown away with the amount of verified information she shares in her book, Montana UFOs and Extraterrestrials. I'm going to have you give your name and your title.
Okay, my name is Joan Bird. I don't know what to say for a title.
Doctor?
Well, yeah, I have one of those. What I say is I'm still recovering from my academic PhD.
There you go.
But I do have one of those, yeah.
Okay. And what do you like me to call you?
Joan is fine.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And I think it was last June when I got to hear you speak at the library at West Yellowstone. And I've been looking a long time for someone that is studying UFOs in Montana, and it turns out that's you. So could you tell us about your background and what drew you to study this subject?
Okay. Well, I came to Montana to pursue graduate work in zoology at the University of Montana in Missoula. And that took a while. I did my graduate research in the West Indies on inter-island variation in finches. So I kind of specialized in birds and ecology and behavior, animal behavior. Jane Goodall was one of my, a person that I admire greatly. And she kind of broke out new territory for those who wanted to do work in the field in behavior. So yeah, she was a significant influence. Anyway, that's how I got here. You know, I took some time out when I ran out of money to do some work in conservation. And then when I finished my doctorate, I worked for the Nature Conservancy for a number of years, and then for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Did work for a number of different conservation organizations and also some writing, some nature interpretation writing. But I got very, I've always been interested in unexplained phenomenon and things that we don't have answers for, because I've always felt like there's important information there if we dig. So we had these crop circles that showed up in northwestern Montana, north of Kalispell. And at the time I was working a couple of jobs, and I had, my son was at home, and it was just more than I could do to follow up on it. But my job ended, and my main job, and I really was wanting to get into doing more writing, which I was doing some of at the time. And I started looking at those crop circles, and although the first one that happened in 1998, I'm pretty sure was human made. As I started investigating crop circles, I became convinced that many of them, especially all the ones going on in England, were not man-made. And when we had the second one in 1999, we actually had a crop circle researcher who was able to get information on that crop circle that indicated that there were unusual energies involved, and that it showed the signs of crop circles that are made in some mysterious way that we didn't understand. And then there were two more in the year 2000, and it was also true of those as well. So that kind of lit my fire about crop circles anyway. And my husband came home one night and he said, there's a woman talking about crop circles on late night radio, coast to coast with Art Bell. A whole other reality for truck drivers, insomniacs, and people who like to think about weird stuff. So we turned it on and listened to her, and she had a new book out called Glimpses of Other Realities, High Strangeness. Then I ordered the book thinking it was going to be about crop circles, and the first chapter was about military witnesses who have had either sightings of UFOs or have been exposed to them in some way, and the ways that they have been pushed into keeping quiet about it. So one of those first stories was Robert Salas, who was involved with the Minuteman missiles, and he was a launch control officer when there was a UFO that was sighted at a distance and then later hovering right over the launch control facility. And while that was happening, all of the 10 missiles on his flight that he was in charge of, the Minuteman missiles, all went no-go. They were all deactivated. Mm-hmm. And while the guards at the surface were yelling about this glowing object that was hovering over the launch control facility. So that convinced me that there's way more going on. And when I realized that this not only had happened, but had been kept secret for so long, because that happened in 1967. And so I'm reading about it in 1998, 99, mm-hmm. and was amazed. And frankly, kind of outraged, mm-hmm. that something of such significance was being kept from us. And not only kept from us, but sort of obfuscated with disinformation and the information coming out saying, oh no, we can explain all of it. And yes, I have some sympathy for the fact that they were totally unable to defend themselves from those incursions into our most secret places that we try to keep any other aerial phenomenon out of, mm-hmm. but that they were going at such lengths to keep it quiet, to keep the public from knowing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that kind of launched me. And at that point, I just started reading whatever books kind of crossed my path. Mm-hmm. And been at it ever since, more or less. Yeah, after I became convinced this was a real phenomenon, I became less interested in the evidence that they exist and increasingly interested in the information that was coming from people that had been abducted, mm-hmm. or that people that felt that they had had contact with advanced civilizations or visitors. So that's kind of been the area in which I am most fascinated.
Wow. I got a copy of your book, Montana UFOs and Extraterrestrials, and I'm so impressed with the documentation in the footnotes and the bibliography, which are just as intriguing to me as the body of the book. Uh-huh. And that book was published in 2013. Have there been any updates on any of these accounts?
Well, not so much on the things that I actually did write about, because mm-hmm. a lot of them were historical events, mm-hmm. and I pretty much exhausted the literature mm-hmm. at the time. I wanted it to be as well documented as possible. And that first chapter about the Mariana UFO film, mm-hmm. boy, was that a long and complicated story with many tangents on it and a lot of documentation out there to find. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was like kind of like a second doctoral thesis. But having done a thesis, you know, I kind of knew what was required, what was necessary in order to document something. So that, in some ways, the PhD was good preparation for doing that chapter especially. And as far as I know, there have not been any more crop circles. And as far as I know, my book is the only place where the four crop circles that we know of in Montana are all documented, and there are photos of all four of them. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, Leo Dvorak, I don't know if he's, I guess he had already passed by the time the book came out, but I was able to see him before he died, and he continued to have contact. He was kind of, he was hesitant about admitting it because, I mean, he was hearing voices. He was telepathing, which in the DSM manual is a symptom of schizophrenia, mm-hmm. pathology of some kind. And so he was wary about admitting that, but it was true. He had become aware of telepathy when he was 12 years old, and he started having these encounters with these beings that looked like us, that were human. And he would find that they would answer questions before he'd actually spoken them. And then he found that sometimes things would pop into their head about questions that they had but hadn't asked yet. So, yeah, he was gradually introduced to the whole idea of telepathy. It's kind of cool.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So let's see. You know, there are still people who think that the Canyon Ferry UFO was real, but I became convinced that that particular event was in fact a hoax. Mm. But there have been a lot of very significant sightings around Canyon Ferry. So, yeah. So no, there's not really that much that I can add to the topics that I covered in the book.
Do you have a favorite story either from the book or that did not get included in the book? And could you tell us about that?
Well, I love the two stories about the contact cases from earlier, from 32 with Leo Dvorak, and from 1940 with Udo Wartana. Mm-hmm. Because they, I mean, because the beings looked like humans, and mm-hmm. they said, among you and you don't know. And both of those people felt that their encounters were very positive, in fact loving.
Yes.
And it's just such a good juxtaposition to some of the scary stuff like the cattle mutilations or whatever mm-hmm. that come out. And not that all of our visitors are benevolent, but I think the majority of them are. And I think that actually the ones that are negative have actually been interacting on the earth for a long time, which is probably also true of the benevolent ones as well. But I think some of the problems that we've had have actually been either started or amplified by some of these off-planet visitors. So hopefully things are shifting here in this time. I think so.
Yeah. How does your work continue today?
Well, I kind of keep track. I try to a little bit of what's going on. Dick O'Connor, who was a medical doctor, retired anesthesiologist, started the UFO library here in Helena. And he has a special interest in crop circles, has spent a lot of time decoding them, because it turns out that there's a lot of information in the crop circles that we did not initially understand. Mm-hmm. A lot of mathematical information, a lot of astronomical information. And there's one fellow that even believes that many of them are blueprints for spacecraft. And that when you make images of them and spin them, it creates a 3D image of a spacecraft.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, David Sarita is the one that I saw a presentation that he did that indicated that. I don't know how many others agree with that, but I thought it was pretty fascinating. So anyway, Dick O'Connor is very interested in crop circles. He's also very interested in cattle mutilations because he is a doctor, because mm-hmm. he's with, you know, medical procedures and whatever. He's made a point of really learning as much as he can about the cattle mutilations. And my understanding is now that Washington, D.C., that Lou Elizondo is very interested in cattle mutilations. That topic has not really been introduced in Washington, D.C. yet, but it may be coming up. And it seems that the military is always on the lookout for things to be wary of, for things to be afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the cattle mutilations are not a very pleasant subject. I had thought at one time that I needed to do a chapter in my book, and publisher was really pushing me to get done with it. So I was like, well, mm-hmm. we have the Three Stalks of Prairie book already out, which is a classic, right. which was done by a Montana sheriff. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to skip cattle mutilations. Not going to go there. But Dick has really dived into it and is talking to people in Montana that have had recent cattle mutilation cases.
Mm.
Yeah, so he's one. Mm-hmm. And another person in Montana is Dr. Michael Masters. And he is what do they call it? A bioanthropologist? So there's another name for it. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, he teaches at Montana Tech. And he has a book out, which is called Identified Flying Objects, because he believes that they're totally real. And his primary thesis at the time he wrote the book, anyway, is that the ETs are us from the future, are humans that have evolved, that time travel back to this time. And I think that that is a good hypothesis in a lot of ways, but I don't think that it explains everything. Mm-hmm. And because he has such a, there's such a good physical anthropology, that's what they call it. So because he has such a good background in that, he can look at the ways that the human body evolved over time and extrapolate how it will continue to evolve, and makes the case that if it continues to evolve the way it has been, that we are going to look like those grays from the future with very large heads, small bodies. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what all else. Anyway, he has himself had some very significant sightings.
Oh,
and perhaps more. Yeah, there's a great interview with him done by Ross Coldheart, who's an Australian journalist, mm-hmm. who's doing some really great interviews. I think because he was from outside the country, he was kind of able to get away from it. And he started out as a skeptic, but has become quite convinced that not only is it real, but it's very important. And he's focusing a lot of time and effort on it and doing wonderful interview. So he interviewed Michael Masters, and that's a great interview. And Mike talks about some of the experiences that he's had. So he is a great researcher and a great speaker. He might be somebody else that you might want to interview.
Oh yes, I have heard of Michael Masters, and yes, that definitely is on my list. Is there somewhere online that people could find that interview with Ross Coldheart?
All you have to do is go on YouTube and search for Ross Coldheart, mm-hmm. Michael Masters.
Okay.
Or Michael Masters, Ross Coldheart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Have our indigenous peoples in Montana had contact that you know of?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So there is in the introduction to the reprinting of Mystery Stalks of Prairie, which was this classic book about cattle mutilations, mm-hmm. that was done by Keith Wolverton, and actually the one who actually wrote it was Roberta Donovan, but he did the research, and Roberta Donovan was a journalist, and Keith was still alive when I was working on my book, and I interviewed him, and I actually knew him already somewhat, and knew that his book was very hard to obtain, that used copies were going for $100, and they had done only a very small printing when it first came out. Mm-hmm. So I asked my publisher if he might be interested in reprinting Mystery Stalks of Prairie, mm-hmm. and he was, and we got permission from Keith Wolverton to do that. Keith actually gave a little epilogue interview. And when it was published, the publisher, Riverbend Press, asked me if I would do an introduction. And I was delighted to be able to do that, because I knew about a cattle mutilation that had happened up on the Blackfeet Reservation, mm-hmm. which is kind of part of the territory that Keith was looking at when he was doing his investigation. Mm-hmm. But this was in 1947, whereas mm-hmm. Keith Wolverton's investigations all took place in 1975 and 76. Mm-hmm. So this was much earlier than a lot of cattle mutilations had happened. And I met this man who had been in a school north of Browning, mm-hmm. and his mother worked at the school, and he was 10 years old when he was waked up one morning by a good friend yelling, "Rod, Rod, come look, come see." And then he grabbed his jeans and went running out and found this dead cow with kind of classic cattle mutilation. You know, lips were gone, genitalia gone, you know, mm-hmm. classic. And as the kids were all gathered around and looking and trying to figure it out, this elder came by and kind of nodded and said, yeah, these are our Sky Brothers. Or, mm-hmm. That's what they call them. Mm-hmm. And over time, that elder shared a lot of information with this friend of mine who went by Elk Chief, but also as Rod Scannendore was his name, mm-hmm. no longer with us. But he had written a book called No More Secrets and had a chapter, Twinkle Twinkle, which talked about this cattle mutilation and then the conversations that he had over time with this elder, who told him that when the elder was young, that they used to get a lot of visitors, a lot of these sky boats coming in and different kinds of visitors. And they knew of three different kinds of beings, mm-hmm. smaller ones that wore, I guess, uniforms that looked like metal but were soft, kind of classic descriptions of grays, and mm-hmm. then tall, blonde, bright blue-eyed visitors that looked very human. And those are often described in the literature as Nordics or Pleiadians or whatever. And then another group that was tall and dark-haired and brown-skinned, like them. Mm. And that this group said, we are your ancestors. Mm. And they would come and visit, and they would have huge feasts, you know, wow. welcoming their ancestors, and the ancestors would share with them about the planet that they came from. Mm-hmm. So they definitely believe that they are descended from sky people. And it is not that unusual for tribes to have those beliefs about their origins. A lot of star people stories. And the Mayans just say outright, you know, we are them. They are us. So among indigenous people, there is a lot of information to that effect. The woman who, another important Montana researcher, was Artie Six Killer Clark. And I'm afraid that Artie has passed, but I don't know that for sure. I haven't been able to find an obituary. But she wrote several books, including one about Mesoamerica, stories of people that she met talking about their connection to star people. But what prompted her to get interested in the first place was that her grandmother, she was part Cherokee, and her grandmother, I think, was maybe full-blood Cherokee, lived on a Cherokee reservation in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And she spent a lot of time with her. And this grandmother told her that when in ancient times, there had been people from the Pleiades. I don't think they called it the Pleiades, but certainly that constellation is something that they would have had a name for and would have known about, that from that place, that these beings had come and lived with them for some time. And after a while, some of them went back to where they came from, but others stayed with them, mm-hmm. intermarried, mm-hmm. and became part of their genetic ancestry. Mm-hmm. So that was what prompted her to wherever she went. She was an education professor at MSU. Mm-hmm. She recruited Indian students to come to MSU and also created a bicultural program at MSU for a while, and she collected the most amazing stories that are in her books. I can't recall the title right off the top of my head, but it's Artie Six Killer Clark, and I think she has four books out.
Wow. Sounds like a fun search.
Yeah. And they're stories.
Yeah.
So it's so fun to listen to hear her stories.
Oh,
amazing
yes.
stories. And they're all anonymous, and in most cases, she doesn't reveal even the reservation or the tribe that they come from.
That's wise.
They try to keep it anonymous. So it's not like they're trying to garner attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like today, and you may have covered this, but just in case we didn't, I wanted to ask you, are UFO and phenomena associated with them still being reported around the world? And what is a reliable source of information about it?
Oh, yeah. They're being reported all over the place. Mm-hmm. And reliable source is very tricky because we have very advanced spacecraft. That's part of the secret space program. That's part of the secrecy. Mm-hmm. And the secrecy is amazing. Whoever it is, the intelligence agencies, a lot of times, you know, the presidents don't even know about.
Thank you to Joan Bird. We'll hear more from her next week. Thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. And to Red, Blue, Black, Silver for his background music today. Thanks to the volunteers and supporters of KGVM. And thank you for listening. You can leave me a voicemail or text at 406-404-6246. You can hear this program broadcast on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, watch the skies, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. And in honor of Native American Heritage Month, here are the artists Foreshadow, Kid Truth, and Yvonne, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, it's Y-V-N-G, and then V-I-N, with their song, United We Native. And thank you, Foreshadow. Listeners, I'll see you next week.
For this moment, on the beat flow, wicked ass potent. Me shout out Artie, y'all get to flowing. Peak girls on the chorus, now we going. Start a wave for the tribe, it's the motion. Going up with my tribe, explosion. It's young Vinegar's chief, I ain't joking. Money moves for the fam, that's a slogan. Did you wash your hands? Huh? Did you keep your distance? Sit back, all you gotta do is listen. When the elders talk, you know I listen. I feel the hand drums and my heart is hitting. It's a good medicine, it's uplifting. In this rap game, I'ma make a living. The young boy throw bread, yeah, I'm gifted.
Survive bloodlines, a whole genocide. Try to kill us with the smallpox and blood quantum be still at large. Strong together, yeah, here we stand. With the blood of a chief running through my veins. Protect your people and the language too. I'll bring you back to the land with me. This for my people, I ain't trying to lose. Through thick and thin, no, I got you. So choose wisely every move you make. We red strong, we'll never break. Unite as one, make the earthquake. Kuni strong all through my veins. Every step that I'm finna take. Kuni strong all through my veins.
I woke up this morning with my family on my mind. I smudge my body, wash my hands, and say no to COVID-19. Give me in cool momentum, my body, still my temple. I treat it with respect, so there's nothing that's accidental. Hey, still gotta love your people. All of us are made so equal. For the elder, sweet grass and the eagle feathers. We indigenous, resilient, strong, beautiful, brilliant. Artie Foreshadow.